This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org. We're visiting for much of the hour today with Dan Moldea, the remarkable reporter based in Washington, D.C., where he has worked for almost a half century. He has, of course, uncovered nuggets about personal lives of politicians that resulted in career changes for Bob Livingston, for David Vitter, for Newt Gingrich. And he's written some of the best investigative books of all time, and a few of them that have been showcased on this show. The Killing of Robert F. Kennedy, An Investigation of Motive, Means, and Opportunity. That was in 1995. Evidence Dismissed, The Inside Story of the Police Investigation of O.J. Simpson. A Washington Tragedy, How the Suicide of Vincent Foster Ignited a Political Firestorm. Confessions of a Guerrilla Writer, which was his autobiography. Hollywood Confidential, A True Story of Wiretapping, Friendship, and Betrayal, and Money, Politics, and Corruption in U.S. Higher Education. That one was written last year. And it all started with the Hoffa Wars in 1978. Teamsters, Rebels, Politicians, and the Mob. Dan Moldea has been chasing the killer of Jimmy Hoffa, or the killers, for 46 years, and he believes that he is close to uncovering the remains of the former Teamsters boss who died in 1975. We'll talk a bit about that as well. And again, if you would like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. And for those who've heard Dan on our show, we know he's from the left side of the political spectrum. And of late, we've had several people from the other side. And we're 2 weeks now removed from what happened in New Jersey and in Virginia. In New Jersey, the governor, Phil Murphy, barely held on in a Democratic state. And in Virginia, in a state that has been veering Democratic, it went for Hillary Clinton and for Joseph Biden, the victor was not the Democrat. Terry McAuliffe, the former governor, former head of the Democratic National Committee, was defeated. And the New York Times, in the aftermath of the big loss for the Democratic Party in Virginia, wrote this on its editorial pages on the Friday, November 5th. Tuesday's election result trend lines were a political nightmare for Democrats. No Democrat who cares about winning elections in 2022 and the presidential race in 2024 should see them as anything less. Familiar takeaways like wake-up call and warning shot do not do justice here because the danger of ignoring those trends are too great. What would do justice, and what is badly needed, is an honest conversation in the Democratic Party about how to return to the moderate policies and values that fueled the blue wave victories in 2018 and won Joe Biden the presidency in 2020. Given the stakes for the country, from urgent climate and social spending needs to the future of democracy, Americans badly need a rolling conversation, and in the coming weeks and months, about how moderate voters of all affiliations can coalesce behind and guide the only party right now that shows an interest in governing and preserving democratic norms. The results in Virginia are a grave marker of political peril. Virginia is a blue state. It hasn't been a battleground in years. Biden won there in 2020 by 10 points. A year later, the Democratic nominee for governor lost by 2.5 percentage points. And Republicans flipped two other statewide offices, lieutenant governor and attorney general, that they have not won in 12 years. Virginia is a cross-section of suburbs, education levels, and racial diversity that is a mirror of what is a winning, coalition-driven Democratic Party. Democrats lost there, even with a longtime moderate as their candidate for governor, because the party has become distracted from crucial issues like the economy, inflation, ending the coronavirus pandemic, and restoring normalcy in schools, and is not offering moderate, unifying solutions to them. Republicans now have a playbook for future elections based on their nominee for governor, Glenn Youngkin, who overperformed with independents and cut into Democrats' support in the suburbs and among women. Dan Moldea, who lives a stone's throw from the Commonwealth of Virginia, your take on what happened 2 weeks ago.
First of all, how are you, Jim? Always a pleasure to be on your program.
Great to hear your voice, my friend.
I like Terry McAuliffe a lot. I'm a centrist, and I believe that you run from the center, and I think you govern from the center. I think that's the best way to have consensus and to create the atmosphere for compromise, which is so desperately needed here. Over in Virginia, Youngkin didn't have a primary. And if he had had, he was selected by the state party to be the nominee for governor. And if he had had a primary, that means that he would have been running up against some right-wing knuckle-dragger, Trump supporter, and that would have been fraught with peril for Youngkin. And any other Republican, they're saying this is a playbook for the future, but that's only if there's not a primary. Also, Youngkin really ran one hell of a campaign here in this area. It was a very upbeat, positive campaign focusing on family values and, you know, all that stuff, whether it's legitimate or sincere as far as he concerns, that remains to be seen. But meantime, Terry McAuliffe, an experienced politician who was an excellent governor in Virginia, ran the dumbest campaign probably in American history, I think. I remember the opening commercial he had. He was sitting down while an elderly lady came up to him, and he was shaking hands, sitting down as the elderly lady was coming up to him to shake hands. He did not stand up for the elderly lady, and they kept on running that commercial. And secondly, when he said the words to the effect of, "I don't think parents should be involved in their children's education," I think I'm diminishing what his actual words were, but that was what was interpreted. And then Youngkin came out and really exploited that. So I think it was a combination of Youngkin not being forced into Trump's corner because he ran alone, he didn't have a primary, that he ran a brilliant ad campaign, and that McAuliffe ran a stupid campaign. I think it really came down to that. I wouldn't take too much out of Virginia because of those three factors.
Well, this woke culture that some are referring to, and Democrats are sensitive people, and there are, of course, injustices, both on gender and in race in our country, and the Democratic Party is the party of today that is trying to address that. But nonetheless, the political correctness, is there a backlash to that?
Well, you know, it just goes down to district by district. In safe districts, you know, sure, anything goes. I mean, you could be a dead person and have a D by your name, and you're elected. Just like in other districts, right-wing districts, if you have an R by your name, you could be dead and you're elected. What's happened recently is I think that the left of the Democratic Party have pretended like they have votes they don't have, and they've been acting like they can make certain demands on others where they don't have the votes to enforce what they're claiming. And consequently, a lot of havoc has been raised, not only by that minority of left people, but also by these Joe Manchin and by Sinema, this woman from Arizona. I find no principle involved in them, and I think they're giving centrists a bad name. It drives me nuts when they say the two centrists are confusing this. I don't view either one of them as centrists. I view them both as political opportunists and money grabbers. That's the way I view them. And when Joe Manchin is driving his Maserati and going to the yacht that's parked over here in the pier, that moored over here in the pier, it drives me nuts to see that. In the meantime, he's diminishing the need for some of these social programs to be passed in the midst of, in the wake of, in the future of the pandemic. And so I think that I view both Sinema and Manchin as being outliers. I do not consider them centrist. I do not consider them legitimate. I'm furious with the chaos that they've caused. But meantime, I'm equally upset by the AOC, what do they call them themselves? The gang, the crew, what the hell do they call themselves? What is it? I'm sorry? The pack? The pack? What do they call themselves? The pack?
The Democratic liberal group, the progressive group, the for all intents, the progressive pack, let's call them that.
Right. And once again, they're playing their hand like they've got, you know, they're playing their hand like they can win the hand, and they're not in a winning position right now. So as a consequence, the entire situation is confused. The Democratic Party looks like it's completely split up when it's really not. You know, people like Trump unify the party. The situation with January 6th unifies the party, and the committee that's been created is unifying the party. So there's a lot there for the Democrats. And also with Trump present on the scene, I believe this is a huge negative for the Republicans, is having Trump's presence so clear and present there. I do not see any way that this guy runs in 2024 successfully. And I think that if the Democrats continue to play, they were saying, oh, you can't connect a politician to Trump and expect it to be successful. I totally disagree with that. Trump is a complete madman. Uh-huh.
All right. Well, a listener notes that the progressive group is called the squad. And I did not know that Joe Manchin drives a Maserati. And Gustavo just sent an email to me saying I need to pick up the pace and drive a better car. I drive a Miata. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. The famed reporter Dan Moldea joining us from Washington, D.C., where Democrats are trying to survey the landscape after losing the governorship in Virginia. And this stuff has happened before in off-year elections, but is it a harbinger of what might happen in 2022? Some people are believing that this will be a tough cycle for Democrats who hold narrow leads as far as the majority party in both the Senate with no room to spare and in the House with just a few seats to spare. Again, 877-217-5757. And a listener notes the differences. In fact, Dana Milbank wrote a column about this. McAuliffe lost. It was a relatively close race, 2.5 points. And in New Jersey, the Democrat Phil Murphy, he came on strong at the end when the urban centers came through, and he won by 2.3 points. So the elections, as far as margin, were almost identical. Well, McAuliffe conceded defeat the morning after the election and wished Glenn Youngkin the best. Citarelli, to my knowledge, has yet to concede the election, and Milbank wrote that this is the playbook that has ongoing in American politics. A, the Republican wins. B, the Democrats stole the election. Heads, I win. Tails, you cheated. A free society cannot function this way. Do we have a real problem in America when every time a candidate tied to Donald Trump loses, he or she says, voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud? Dan Moldea?
Well, I think that the playbook should be to continue to attack Trump and anyone who supports him, who runs for public office. I mean, I used to question people who supported Trump and their personal politics, but now I question their basic sense of right and wrong. After the Capitol insurrection on January 6th, I mean, that was one of the most disgraceful situations we've ever seen, and the evidence as it continues to roll in shows that this was basically an attempted coup against the United States government that was precipitated by the sitting president of the United States, who had just been defeated and was claiming that the election was fraudulent, consistent with exactly what you've been saying here about the new playbook for the Republicans. You know, heads I win, tails you cheated. And I think that's an apt description, and I think that needs to be attacked. And I think that there are 30% of the population will support this, you know, this knuckle-dragging Republican Party that they have out there right now. Meantime, there are some very legitimate Republicans out there. Your senator has been a surprise to me. I mean, he's been kind of extraordinary in some of the things he's been doing and saying. And I, you know, I've never liked Kennedy very much, but
I'm telling you, it's Cassidy. Cassidy, and not Kennedy.
Cassidy. Yeah. Kennedy's a knuckle dragger.
Oh, he's on the Trump train, and he was a liberal Democrat in 2004 when he ran for the U.S. Senate as a Democratic supporter of John Kerry. Ellen Bander says, thank you, Jim, for having an unapologetic, honest guest who's telling the truth, referring to Mr. Moldea. And we have some folks that we will go to the phone lines. There are a couple lines open, though, if you'd like to grab them, 877-217-5757. story that appeared in the New York Times a few days ago, actually 6 days ago, says it starts with a quote from Michael Flynn. The general says that we are essentially in a national emergency, General Flynn declared on January 5th of this year during an interview with the internet conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, recorded in a luxurious suite at the Willard Intercontinental Hotel, not far from where Dan lives, near the White House. The truth is going to come out, said Mr. Flynn, the former three-star general and national security advisor. Donald Trump will continue to be the president of the United States for the next 4 years. In another room of the five-star hotel, a phalanx of lawyers and political advisors for Mr. Trump, including Rudy Giuliani, Bernard Carrick, and John Eastman, worked on legal strategy to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president. What unfolded at the Willard Hotel in the hours before the Capitol riot has become a prime focus of the House committee investigating the January 6th attack, as the panel intensifies its scrutiny into whether there was any coordination or tie between those pushing a legal strategy to overturn the election and those who stormed the Capitol that day as Congress met to count the electoral votes to formalize Mr. Biden's victory. Is there a connection, or is it too early to tell, or is there no connection, Dan?
I view all of this as sedition. I mean, I think Flynn's words as general, this once respected general, I think basically he's been talking sedition. If you listen to Steve Bannon, who's just wearing his indictment like a badge of honor here in Washington yesterday, and the disgraceful performance that he had before the cameras, and considering the words that he used the day before the insurrection, where, you know, get ready, we're going to, you know, this is going to be the biggest thing ever. I mean, he was essentially supercharging the event that occurred the following day and the supporters. You know, Alex Jones just got his head handed to him in front of, I guess, a Connecticut court over the false statements that he's been making about some of the school shootings. And Rudy Giuliani is a man who was at one time respected, not by me, and I'm a mob reporter, and I have been for 47 years, and I had zero respect for Rudy Giuliani, even when he was U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and even when he was mayor of New York, and supposedly was the great mob hunter. The real mob hunter in New York at that time was a guy named Ron Goldstock. It was Ron Goldstock who was making those cases. Rudy Giuliani was riding on the success of Ron Goldstock. And as far as I'm concerned, Rudy Giuliani is a guy who's getting his comeuppance right now, too. And it seems as though Trump has completely abandoned him, as he does all of his friends, whether it's Rudy Giuliani or Mike Pence. God, what he did to Mike Pence. No one could have been a bigger stooge for Donald Trump than Mike Pence. And look what he did to him on the day of the insurrection. He hung him out to dry, and he left him for dead.
Rose on government. Rose, good morning. You're on with Dan. Hi, Rose.
Good morning. That report that you talked about that said that they're not paying attention to the pandemic, I think the Democrats are paying attention to the pandemic. It's people who are not. If you don't get vaccinated, it's your own choice. And they're fueling this pandemic with the lies that Trump made.
All right. Well, what about the pandemic becoming a political football? Dan, that's unfortunate.
I think she's right. I think the lady's right. I think she's right on target on this. And I think that, I mean, this is a very serious situation, which has become a very political situation. And, you know, you have to be, I've had two first cousins and the husband of another first cousin who've died from the COVID. And all three of them were Trump supporters, big Trump supporters, didn't want to get vaccinated, didn't want to, you know, deal with any of these things. And as a consequence, once again, you know, Donald Trump doesn't care about anybody but himself. The person who really, I think, had the biggest impact on the 2020 election was the great investigative journalist Bob Woodward. He had quoted Donald Trump on February 7th, 2020, saying that he knew that the virus was airborne, and that he was tamping this down because he didn't want to cause any kind of a panic. Well, what we needed at that time, in February 7th, 2020, like about 5-6 weeks before this thing really, really went wide, was a leader to come in and say, let's get a hold of this thing. And I wonder how many people died as a result of Trump's incompetence.
All right. And Dan is ready to take some callers, and we do have a full board now, so please be patient. 877-217-5757. James in Metairie. James, you're on with Dan. Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning. Talk about Mr. Muldoon, the right-wing Republicans look upon people like Bill Cassidy as one of those dreaded rhinos, and they want to purge the party of all the rhinos and get strong conservatives in. Now, there's an article that's in I'm looking at a website here talking about John Carl's new book called Betrayal, in which he's talking about how Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on the night of January 6th talked about potentially invoking the 25th Amendment to get rid of this renegade president. Your comments, please.
All right. Dan, I don't think Trump is crazy, but he certainly has a following that some are less stable than he, and some of the people around him wondered about his sanity at points. That is a true story based on many accounts, but he's just Donald Trump. He's been like this, and it's worked pretty well for him through the years.
Right. I think Pompeo denied. I think it was first he left it open. I think he sort of gave a non-denial statement about that. I think this gentleman's right in what he's saying.
All right. 877-217-5757. Thanks, James. We'll return and start with Patrick in Ennis-Walda States and then David in Atlanta. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. And Dan Mulday is with us for a bit longer. Let's go to Patrick in Ennis-Walda States. Patrick, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, good morning. I think what's hurting the Democrat Party right now is the massive inflation we're just beginning to see, and the president's response is to cut energy. I mean, he was talking about maybe stopping a pipeline in Michigan just a couple weeks ago. I think he's backed off of that. But, I mean, it's like we got no energy, pipelines being shut down, gas prices going up. We're seeing it in our groceries. The cost of groceries are going way up. Mm-hmm. And
well, the stock market's going up and the deficit's coming down, Patrick.
Because people are printing money.
And Exxon stock is going through the roof under Joseph Robinette Biden.
To prop up the stock market. Printing money to prop up the stock market. That's another thing, massive printing of money.
Not all stocks are going up, my friend. Not all are. But ExxonMobil's doing pretty well, and there is plenty of drilling going on in the country right now. Joe Biden's not killing the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, he is, and that's the
oil and gas industry is going to have to adapt no matter who the president is, Patrick. But Joe Biden hasn't gotten credit for a stock market rise in his 10 months of almost 20%, Dan, and the deficit went down 10% in the first year. Most of the fiscal year, 9 months of it, was under Joe Biden. And certainly employment is better than it was when Donald Trump left office. Why isn't Biden thumping his chest? Why is he out there saying, I'm the savior? Only I can handle this as Donald John Trump did.
Well, I could solve it. When Obama was president and the stock market was tripling, Donald Trump was saying, well, the president has nothing to do with that, and that's not his responsibility. When he's president and the stock market was doing well, he took all the credit for it. And then, of course, with Joe Biden going up and this thing going over 36,000, the rap was, oh, well, the president doesn't have anything. Only when Trump is president have anything to do with anything. And also, it's always been the president really doesn't have much to do with the oil prices, but except when Donald Trump was president, and of course, he took credit for that as well.
And Exxon stock, when Biden took office, looks like it was at about $44 a share. It's now trading, as we speak, at $64.90 per share. David in Atlanta. Good morning, David. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, gentlemen, thanks for having my favorite guest on, Jim. I'd like to tell Patrick, if Trump would not have torn up the Iranian nuclear agreement, there'd be a lot more Iranian oil on the world market, and we'd have less inflation and lower gas prices. And the Iranian situation now is much worse than it was under previous presidents. Trump got nothing in return for it. And furthermore, if the Republicans would embrace more electric vehicles, there would be less demand for oil and gasoline, and prices would come down. So the Republicans love to attack and make charges that are totally unfounded and unbased, and they could blame themselves for it.
All right. Well, David's, of course, a partisan from the left, just as Patrick is from the right. And the truth is sometimes in the middle. Sometimes it shades one way or the other. But, Dan, who is closer to the truth these days, the left-wing zealots or the right-wing zealots? Dan Moldea. Did we lose Dan? I don't think Dan is ever speechless. So, Alondra, do we have him? Let's try Phil in Jefferson Terrace while we're waiting for Dan to come back. Phil, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning to you, sir. All right, and I see that our phone lines have just taken a turn for the worse. So that's the way it's happened here on occasion, and thank you for your patience. And, of course, we will take emails. But the deficit, which went down under President Clinton and then went back up under President George Bush II and then went down under Obama and then went up under President Trump, in the first year under Biden, it went from a record $3.1 trillion to $2.8 trillion. So we definitely have a case in which Democratic presidents do better with money than do Republicans. And the perception is just the opposite of that. And the stock market, of course, had its best performance under President Clinton. Reagan and Bush 1 did very well. Bush 2 actually lost ground in the stock market. And Dan's right. Under Obama, from where it went down to about 6,500 to where he left, 20,000, it did triple. 877-217-5757. I think we're back on. And Dan, we obviously have hyperbole from both sides, but do you think that one side or the other is more guilty of shading the truth or perhaps outright lying than the other? What's your thought about that?
Well, first of all, I thank David, my favorite caller, on your program, for always having a level-headed view of events. I think everyone is engaging in hyperbole. It's everything is so tribal right now. Once again, when the extremes are making all the noise, the people in the center are the people who are going to suffer. And once again, I'm a centrist. I believe in running from the center. I believe in governing from the center, because what government's about is compromise. Everybody has opinions. And what you do is you try to come to that happy middle. And that's the way government was when I first came to this town in 1976. What can you believe these days? Everyone walks around believing they own absolute truth. I certainly don't own absolute truth. I don't know too many people who do. But everyone believes that they do, in fact, own absolute truth. And as a consequence, everyone is they dig in and their positions, and it's hard mm-hmm. to reason with people, well, argue with people who think they own absolute truth.
Well, and I've said before, if either side believes it has a monopoly on virtue, it is sadly wrong. Skipper in Gonzales. Skipper, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Skipper.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to ask if our guest believes that Congress is more in charge of the purse strings or is the president, and during these upswings and downswings, which party was in control of Congress? Is that more relevant than who's in actually the presidency?
Well, it does matter, and sometimes divided government is good, but in 1993, when Bill Clinton got us out of a big hole left by Reagan and Bush regarding the deficit, if you remember, in August 4th of that year, there was a economic plan presented by the 42nd American president, William Jefferson Clinton, that got no Republican votes in either chamber, zero right. votes. Al Gore had to cast the deciding vote in the Senate. And yet that was what stimulated the economy. The deficit went away. Clinton left with a surplus, and he had records in the stock market. And people said the interest rates were higher then than they are now. Bill Clinton was the person who made this economy roar in the 1980s. In the 1990s. Reagan, of course, had some success in the 80s, but they were accompanied with record deficits. And that was with one party in charge, Dan Moldea. One party, the Democrats at the right. time, first 2 years of Clinton, had the House, the Senate, and the White House, as they do now. And Clinton was able to get more done than Biden. Biden has been stymied by Sinema and Manchin, Maserati Manchin. I didn't know that Joe Manchin drove a Maserati.
Yeah, I was just checking it to make sure I was right. I see here. Of course, Joe Manchin drives a Maserati by vice. The New York Post, activist swore Manchin's Maserati a D.C. garage. Yeah. He owns a Maserati. He drives a Maserati. And I don't think that's exactly the right message for people who are suffering right now. And legislation that he's blocking, I don't think that's quite right. At the same time, I don't think that the squad, right, the squad should be screaming about getting their far-left agenda passed when it's a 50-50 split in the Senate. I mean, you don't have the votes. You should shut up. I mean, lefties in safe districts, centrists in swing districts. I think that's the way it works, and that's the way you win.
Well, somebody once referred to politics as the art of the possible, and it is impossible to get the agenda of the squad through, and because of that, you take what you can get. And I'm going to defend Joe Manchin for a moment. He represents mm-hmm. a state, Dan, that every county went for Donald Trump, and he's a Democrat, right. And he wants to keep right. his job. So I can understand what he's doing far more than I can what Senator Sinema is doing.
I think Manchin's running for president. That's what I think. I think Manchin's setting himself up. He's seeing the polarization between the far right and the far left, who are making all the noise. The center is wide open right now, and I think he's trying to make a claim for the center. I think Joe Manchin's going to run for president.
All right, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Dan. Good morning to you.
Yes, sir. Good morning. I have to say, it's been such a relief not to have Donald Trump on Facebook or and have his ridiculous statement on every 10 seconds. How is this able to happen? And I think it's a good thing. I contribute to the steel wall keeping him off of our airwaves.
All right. What about it's Twitter, really, that has stymied right. President Trump. And for those of us who believe in the First Amendment, I have some severe questions about stopping him. But on the other hand, he did spread a lot of mistruths, Dan, untruths. And as a result of that, Twitter and Facebook and some of these others had enough.
And they gave him a lifetime ban, and well-deserved. And I hope they never lift that ban. This guy is a menace. He's a menace to society, and he should be shut down by those who could shut down his false and reckless and malicious message.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate. He's a menace maybe to you and me and others, but what about those who believe Joe Biden's a menace? Do we shut him down too?
Well, I think it's I saw Steve Bannon talking about free speech of the First Amendment. Free speech of the First Amendment doesn't really apply to private enterprises. And that's like the New York Times. They control the content of what goes in their paper. There's no freedom of speech here. I mean, I sued the New York Times for a libel for a case that lasted longer than World War II, as you know. It was a case that I had won, and then the Court of Appeals took it away from me. It was about a review of my book on the NFL and the Mafia, where the reviewer said things I never said, claimed that I didn't say.
All right, and Dan sued the New York Times, so he knows what it's like to be in a courtroom about libel, and we'll talk a bit more with him when we return. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're wrapping it up with reporter Dan Moldea in Washington, and then we'll hear from Kevin Birmingham, a brilliant biography about Dostoevsky, the sinner and the saint. But Dan, before we go, how's the Hoffa Trail?
Good. I think I got it. Stay tuned. I have alleged that the person who buried Hoffa was a guy named Paul Coppola, who was the co-owner of a dump site in Jersey City, New Jersey. The only person he told was his oldest son, Frank Coppola, and the only person Frank told was me. Paul died in March of 2008. Frank died in March of 2020, and I've given everything I know to the FBI. And so the FBI is approaching this very carefully. There's an environmental problem here. The body was buried, and there were 15 to 30 steel drums placed on top of it, filled with adhesives, which are toxic. And once again, the FBI, there's a bridge right overhead, the Pulaski Skyway, which connects Jersey City to Newark. And I believe I've got it. And we'll see very shortly whether I'm right or wrong. If I'm wrong, a lot of people are going to be dancing on my head. If I'm right, it's going to be a nice little finale for a 71-year-old man who's been out here fighting a good fight for a long time.
For 46 years. Thank you, Dan. Always good to talk with you. See you soon in the big city. Thank you. We're joined now by Kevin Birmingham. He is a remarkable biographer and writer. Kevin is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Most Dangerous Book, which won a Penn New England Award and the Truman Capote Award for Literary Criticism. He's been named a public scholar by the National Endowment for the Humanities, received his PhD in English from Harvard, and he has taken on Dostoevsky, whose body of works consists of 12 novels, 4 novellas, 16 short stories, numerous other works, and many literary critics rank this man, who wrote during the Civil War period, as one of the great novelists of all the world literature. His multiple works are considered masterpieces, and the book is The Sinner and the Saint. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Well, you talk about taking on a legend. You have done it. And you're a man of letters, and you've written about James Joyce, but this guy is the real deal, isn't he, when you're talking about literature through the ages?
Yeah, Dostoevsky was, you know, celebrated as an up-and-coming Russian novelist when he was only 24 years old and before his first book was even published. 4 years later, when he was 28, he was arrested by the Tsar's secret police, and he eventually spent a decade in Siberia for spreading what the Tsar's regime called, free thinking. He basically had to restart his career in 1860 when he finally returned to St. Petersburg. And he was, by that point, suffering from temporal lobe epilepsy, and he had a gambling addiction. So he had a pretty wild ride as a writer.
Well, Crime and Punishment advanced a revolution in the way we understand consciousness in the modern world. And how did it come about?
So Crime and Punishment is the story of an axe murderer by told through the lens of the murderer's perspective. And the majority of the book is really about whether or not Raskolnikov is going to get caught. It eventually becomes a detective novel. And what was astonishing for readers at the time was that the murderer was someone who was intelligent, someone who was well-educated, someone who was handsome, someone who claimed to be murdering a pawnbroker and her sister for altruistic purposes. Dostoevsky came up with the idea for Crime and Punishment, at least partly because he had read about a murderer named Pierre-François Lacenaire, who was tried in Paris in 1835. He was also involved in a double murder of two people, one with an axe, another person was murdered with a sharpened file. The murderer was debonair, he was well-educated, he was handsome. A cult began to grow up around Lacenaire, and people were captivated by him, and he wrote his memoirs. And in his memoirs, he claimed that he was killing people in order to right the wrongs of an unjust society. Dostoevsky read about all of this, read about the celebrity that attended Lacenaire, and was appalled. I mean, people were sending him fruit baskets, they were writing him letters and poems, they were interviewing him in prison. After he was executed, his hand was mummified and it was owned by several different people. People were trying to, you know, get a glimpse of a wax likeness of his head. And what Dostoevsky saw was that, you know, here was a person who claimed to be killing for altruistic purposes, but was really just killing for the sake of killing. It was sheer destructiveness. And he used that to craft Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment.
The book from Kevin Birmingham is Dostoevsky and the Gentleman Murderer Who Inspired a Masterpiece. You write that Crime and Punishment had a tumultuous start. How so?
Well, Dostoevsky was addicted to gambling, and particularly he was addicted to roulette. He would leave Russia to escape his creditors and take the last money that he had in order to gamble at the roulette table. He was stuck in Wiesbaden, Germany, in a casino town because he couldn't pay the bill for his hotel room. the proprietor of the hotel was not giving him meals, they were not replacing his candles, and they were threatening to have him arrested by the local police for a non-payment of a bill. So he frantically tried to come up with a story that someone in Russia would pay him in advance for so that he could pay his bill and take a train back to St. Petersburg. That story ended up becoming Crime and Punishment. He thought that it was just going to be a short story, but as time went on, it grew into an incredible novel. And it was serialized through 1866. His gambling debts got worse. They didn't get better. And in the middle of writing Crime and Punishment, he had to write another novel called The Gambler. And a month before that deadline was due, he hadn't written a single word of it. And so one of his friends said, you know what, why don't you hire a stenographer to help you write this novel in time? And he did. The stenographer came and took dictation from Dostoevsky. She was a young woman, and they fell in love over the course of that month. He finished the novel successfully. Then he dictated the rest of Crime and Punishment to her, and a few weeks after Crime and Punishment was complete, they got married.
All right. Well, Dostoevsky purportedly had numerous extramarital affairs. He loved women. Women loved him. And you say more than a few, and one in particular had an immense impact on his writing. Tell us about Anna.
Well, Anna, I don't think it was an affair. It was, it depends on what we mean by the term affair. It was a courtship. Anna was a deep admirer of Dostoevsky. Her father had read Dostoevsky since she was a little girl. And by the time she met him when she was in her early 20s, he was already, for her, this towering figure. And for Dostoevsky, he wasn't quite sure what to make of a young woman like her. But she was intelligent. She was a keen reader. He would ask her what she thought about his characters, and she would tell him the truth. He changed his writing because of her. His entire method changed because of her. And soon after they got married, he was he was finally grounded for the first time. He was in love, really, for the first time. And he had someone who could provide him with some sense of stability and ultimately provided him with a family, which is something that he had always wanted.
Kevin Birmingham is the writer. The book is about Dostoevsky, one of the great writers of all time. And we're going back to the mid-19th century. The book is The Sinner and the Saint and the Gentleman Murderer Who Inspired a Masterpiece, Dostoevsky. Now, a listener, this is Michael at LSU asking about Dostoevsky's religious beliefs. They were a big part of his being, weren't they?
Yeah, and they were always strained. You know, he said early on that meaning in his 20s, that he would always be a creature of doubt. And he struggled constantly with his sense of doubt, as well as his abiding sense of faith. He was a Christian. He firmly believed in God and in the goodness and the grace of God. And, you know, he had a near-death experience when he was just a young man because he thought that he was going to be executed. And he was marched out into a cold square in snowy St. Petersburg. And three men in front of him were tied to stakes and faced a rifle squad. And he was next in line. The Tsar ultimately spared everyone's life. And Dostoevsky felt resurrected, and that sense of feeling resurrected and feeling that he had a calling stayed with him. And yet, like all of his characters, Dostoevsky was divided within himself. He was sort of a double within himself. There was an angel and a devil on either of his shoulders, and he struggled to come to terms with his goodness and with his impulse for destructive behavior.
His work, as we have to part, unfortunately, Kevin, it certainly has, if anything, been enhanced through the years. He is a giant, isn't he?
Yeah, his themes are eternal. They resonate throughout time. You know, one of the things that he focuses on is the inherent irrationality of people. We like to think of people as acting in their own self-interest and learning from their mistakes. Dostoevsky showed us that people don't normally do that.
Thank you, sir. Congrats, Kevin Birmingham. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Back tomorrow. Stay safe. Stay tuned.